Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Digitally Uploaded podcast. We've got a great week of stuff to talk about this week. We're going to be talking all about JRPGs, which is, you know, our favourite subject, actually. But, yeah, it should be a good conversation. With me this week, just the one person, we've got Jay from JRPG, the rather great YouTube channel that you should definitely be checking out. G'day, Jay. How are you going?
Well, not too bad. How are you?
Not too bad. And I think that might be the very first time I've actually said g'day on a podcast. That's
Well, it was Australia Day yesterday.
It was indeed. Good old Invasion Day. Okay, so yeah, we'll cut to some Happy Mickey music. Alan's going to kill me for this one this week, this track I've selected. I've picked a cover of Heaven is a Place on Earth with Hatsune Miku's voice. And yeah, once Alan hears that, he's going to probably quit on me and we'll never get a podcast done again. But anyway, it's a good track. It's fun. I enjoyed it. So off we go. And welcome back, everybody. Okay, so for the first section of the podcast this week, we thought we'd look at the PlayStation 4, actually, and JRPGs in general for it. It's halfway through its life now, maybe towards the second
Yeah, I'd say I've probably got like
console, I guess.
Probably got two more years, I reckon.
Yeah, I imagine we'll probably start hearing rumblings about the PlayStation 5 this year, and next year it'll probably be unveiled at E3, and then, you know, a year after that.
Release.
Yeah, the year after that it'll be out. I mean, it's a console that's still got great legs on it. The PS4 Pro only recently came out. They've got the VR headwear that they're supporting and doing.
Yeah, I certainly don't think they need a PlayStation 5 anytime soon. I reckon the PlayStation 4 could go another 4 years, but the companies won't see it like that. So Sony and Microsoft won't let that happen.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, they've got to sell a whole bunch more units, you know, to keep the financial results sticking over, and nothing like a new console release to do that. But yeah, I mean, we didn't want to talk about the PS4 itself, but more like the JRPGs that have been on it. Now that it's been around for a long time, there's a big library of JRPGs, and I know I wanted to have a chat about, you know, whether we thought that, you know, compared to some of the other consoles, the Super Nintendo and the PS3, the PS2, whether the JRPG library on the PS4 kind of holds up. I think it does. Don't know about you.
Yeah, I absolutely think it does. I think even more so than the PlayStation 3, which became, you know, a really solid JRPG machine, you know, halfway through its life cycle when people actually started buying it when it was a decent price. I think the PlayStation 4 sort of like almost hit the ground running. Like a year after the release, we just started getting high quality JRPGs left and right. So I think it's a really great console.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the PS3 did become a hell of a console for the JRPGs, like you said, but it took a long time because the sales, I guess, of the console were quite anemic in Japan initially. There were other consoles that Japanese developers could produce games for, I guess. The PSP was doing well, the DS was doing well. There wasn't such a need to, you know, move on to a console that wasn't really selling shifting units in Japan. Halfway through, that all started to change, which was funny enough when I decided I wanted to get a PS3 myself, and it ended up being a great console. But the PS4, like you said, I think Final Fantasy Type-0 was out within a year? After a year?
Yeah, I think it was just after a year.
Yeah, and for me, that was when it really started for the PS4. I mean, there was a couple of JRPGs before that, Amiga Quintet and Natural Doctrine.
Yep.
So they were decent enough. They were very niche, but they were decent enough. And then Disgaea 5 was within the first year, was it?
That was pretty close. That was that came pretty close after, I think, around the time Type-0 was coming out.
Yeah. So for me, it was Type-0 that really kicked things off. And from that point, I kind of found myself playing the PS3 less and less because, you know, the Trails of the Cold Steel series was wrapping up and there weren't so many games being produced for it. Atelier started landing on the PS4 rather than PS3 or, you know, PS4 and PS3 at the same time. Yep. And for me, you know, Atelier is a pretty important franchise as far as my JRPG gaming goes. And I'm really looking forward to the next one, which is out very soon. That was about the point where the PS4 really started to take over. And from that point, it's been pretty unending in terms of the stuff to play.
Yeah, it's been strength after strength, really. Like 2017 was crazy good, like just an insanely good year for JRPGs, and pretty much all of them were PS4.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say that 2017, I honestly think, was the best year for JRPGs we've ever had.
Yeah.
It wasn't just, there were obviously great JRPGs that have been released in other years, Chrono Trigger and Final Fantasy VI and Final Fantasy VII, obviously. But they were kind of individual games, whereas with, you know, 2017, it was it started with Yakuza, moved on to Nier Automata, Persona 5.
Tales of Berseria, Blue Reflection,
Berseria, which was, you know, the first Tales game I can honestly say I absolutely loved. Everything was really pulled up, and it was a great year for the
genre. I know. I mean, it was hard. It's rolling into this year. Like I looked at my January and February list for stuff that I have to play, like I have to either review or play at some point, and there are almost 20 games on it just for January and February.
Yeah, do you think Sony got a bit lucky in a sense that the Nintendo Wii U failed dismally and Microsoft dropped out of the Japanese market entirely? It just seemed to me that the PS4 kind of came at the time where there was, you know, Japanese developers had a choice of doing PS4 or nothing, basically. And they obviously went with PS4. And they started to dip their toes, I guess, into PC game development in a way that they hadn't previously. But, yeah, it was It was. I think the timing was really good for the PS4. It just came at the time where there was no real competition in terms of the Japanese market for any of these developers to work with. So they had to go with it.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and I don't think that they I don't think that they begrudgingly took it either. I think they were pretty happy to make Sony their home. And I mean, we see that even still with the crazy development that we have for the PlayStation Vita, you know, which is. It's certainly not a dead console, but it's not alive, and it can't be easy to develop for. So I think Japanese developers are just happy to be on a PlayStation platform in general.
Yeah, I think the Vita benefited a bit with Japanese developers because it used a similar enough architecture to the PS4 in the sense of, you know, the base coding. And Sony obviously provided tools to help developers port stuff from PS4 to Vita and stuff. And the Japanese developers took advantage of that because the Vita sold well enough in Japan to
be justified. I mean, justified, it still sells a decent amount of consoles week on week in Japan. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. So there was that extra benefit, I guess, to supporting the PS4 platform that you could also then support a handheld platform. Mm-hmm. It's going to be interesting, I guess, to see how things go for the JRPGs going forward because Nintendo is doing such a great job in Japan and is really courting Japanese developers. And obviously, we're starting to see, you know, a lot of Japanese developers also working on Switch, where they worked previously on Vita. So
yeah,
just at the top of my head, I think that's
more where we're headed anyway. I think more developers will move their Vita stuff to the Switch than they will their PS4 stuff to the Switch. I mean, I've said, you know, it's not going to be a standard thing to see PlayStation 4 and Switch releases until, like, at minimum halfway through next year, because all the stuff in development now has been in development before the Switch even existed. But even after that, like, Koei Tecmo seem to be doing like dual PS4 and Switch releases, but I think it's more going to be just your Vita stuff moving to the Switch more so, because Japanese developers have sort of been at this point now where they're dropping support for the PlayStation 3. They're sort of moving off the Vita so they can actually take advantage of the full power of the PS4. And I don't know whether they're going to leash themselves back to the Switch. You know, I think they do want to move forward.
Yeah, I don't think the PS4 is going to stop being the default platform for a lot of these guys.
Absolutely not.
I think there might be one or two third-party Switch exclusives, but I don't think, aside from what Nintendo can actually invest in with the Japanese publishers, I don't think that's going to happen because the PS4 has such great numbers out there in the market. And, you know, especially in Japan, it's got a good foothold and it's become the platform that people who like JRPGs bought, and they bought into it well before they bought a Switch. Switch would be a secondary console for them. So unless everybody starts buying on Switch over PS4, I can't see them giving up on developing for the PS4, at least through the console's life. I think it's still looking good for the PS4. What I'd like to see is some Japanese developers start to work on some RPGs for the VR headset, because that's something that's missing from my VR experience at the moment. There aren't too many JRPGs on it.
Yeah, I see. I don't have the VR yet. I sort of always planned to get it at some point, but yeah, there's not a whole lot to make me want to take that step. There's enough for, you know, a lot of people out there, a lot of gamers, but yes, it is the RPG library is certainly small.
It's a difficult genre, I think, for VR, because amongst other things, it requires you to be kind of, you know, sit in the game for quite a few hours at a time to really get the feel for the genre. Like, you know, it's not something that you can play for half hour bursts of time, whereas VR headsets are more designed for that kind of short play experience. The programming, the rendering, all that stuff that needs to do to go into a VR game is very difficult with kind of the large epic spaces that JRPGs aim for. So yeah, I think the Japanese developers will struggle with it. But that being said, I mean, Compo Heart's working on a VR game. The VR'd up Hyperdimension Neptunia.
So, yes.
It's not actually the seventh game in the series, but it's called Mega Neptunia 7, whatever it is. But yeah, that's getting a VR update, and that's coming out this year. So it'll be interesting to see how that works. Apparently, it heard. And yeah, I won't be
it
complaining
will be
about
it. To see for sure.
Yeah, I won't be complaining about Nep Nep in VR, that's for sure. but yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I'd like to see Koei do a little bit more with VR. They've experimented with it with Dead or Alive and stuff. But they've certainly got games that I'd like to see in VR as well. Mostly all the Gust ones.
Yeah.
But again, it'll be probably won't be for this year. We probably will start to see more JRPGs or Japanese developers experimenting with traditional franchises and genre styles with VR next year.
If not full games, they'll add in little VR modes, little VR stuff. Peach Beach Splash recently just added in the VR mode for the dressing room and stuff like that.
Yeah, or they might try doing mini games set within that kind of world as separate releases, like Monster in the Deep for Final Fantasy 15.
Yeah, exactly. That's the kind of thinking that I have towards it. I don't think we're going to have full RPG experiences, or not that many. You know, there will be a couple that'll try and push that, but there may be more mini stuff, small games, mini games, alternate things, even like little story sequences, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. It'd be good to see, for instance, an Atelia game have a VR mode, or where you can actually, throw stuff into the pot and, stir it around, and it'd be like a, rhythm timing mini game or something to create some ingredients or something. Yeah, those kinds of things would be good if they could start to implement that stuff as well. Fingers crossed.
Absolutely.
On that note, we'll go to listen to some music. We're going to talk about the 3DS and JRPGs in the next section, so we thought we'd throw in some music from one of the 3DS JRPGs, Ever Oasis. It's a lovely track. Enjoy, and we'll be back soon. And welcome back, everybody. Okay, so I think it's fair to say that the 3DS is well and truly on its way out. I know there's a couple of games that will still be released for it over the next year or so. Atlas in particular seems to be pretty keen on continuing to support the hardware for a bit yet. But I think it's safe to say that everybody, well, most everybody has moved on, and the console is now legacy, and that's not a bad thing. I'll still love my 3DS for a long time to come. But it just means that we're talking about it now, and I guess in a sense, more like a retro sense, like we did the DS. So we thought we'd take a look back at the 3DS's library of JRPGs, because that's one genre it did particularly well at, and I don't think I ever really stopped playing the 3DS as long as it was running because of its JRPG library. Actually, no, I'll take that back. I didn't play the 3DS too much from the first year because there was nothing on it.
Yeah.
It was a struggling console. It was a really struggling console at first. I don't know. Anybody who bought the 3DS at the original launch would remember that, I imagine. I think I played Samurai Warriors on it, and that was about it for the first 6 or 8 months or thereabouts.
Yeah, I didn't even get a 3DS in the first year because I wasn't interested in anything.
It all started to turn around when Nintendo slashed the price, I think, and then gave all the early adopters the cheap.
Yeah, I definitely got it after those early adopters got that stuff, I remember.
Oh, so you never got the free NES and GBA games on it?
Yeah, no, I did not.
Ah, okay. Well, yeah, so from that point, I think that's when we started to see a lot of development happening for the console, and it ended up being a very strong JRPG console, I think.
Oh, absolutely. I think it is incredibly strong. The catalog there are thousands and thousands and thousands of hours worth of gameplay there to play, and it's all quality stuff.
Yeah, I think one of the benefits the 3DS had was because it was it didn't have the resolutions, obviously, and it wasn't running the kind of power that the other consoles did. A JRPG developer could still be relatively small, create a full-scale JRPG, and not have to worry about, you know, the visual presentation of it and stuff. And for, you know, if you're working on a console like the PS4, as we're talking about beforehand, if you're going to create a 50, 60, 70, 100-hour-long game, that requires a lot of resources when you're working in high definition. You don't need those kind of resources with a 3DS. So you could be a little bit more experimental. You could make games that were for more niche audiences and that worked in the genre's favor, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And it did, you know, they weren't without complications. You remember Fire Emblem Awakening with the no feet?
And yes, I remember that. That was such an artificial effect.
Yeah, the developers said they did that on purpose because it saved them so much system resources just to not render their feet.
Yeah, I always thought it was just an aesthetic choice, actually. I got over it pretty quickly. I know it annoyed some people right through while they were playing it. But yeah, I just figured it was, you know, this is a deliberately kind of low poly kind of approach to character models. And I kind of liked it, I guess, in the end.
Yeah,
I didn't mind when they put feet back in, but.
Yeah. They said that they were just looking for, you know, to get a smooth frame rate and stuff throughout, and they just found out that if they didn't render the feet, then they gained like the amount of system resources they'd need to have the game run smoothly and look the way it did.
Yeah, and I mean, there were all kinds of examples of developers using various tricks to get over the limitations of the 3DS. I mean, one of the other challenges it had, it didn't render realistically proportioned people very well because the resolution of the screen was so low, you couldn't see facial features and stuff. So that's why you ended up with a lot of JRPGs that had the kind of the big bobble-headed characters with the oversized heads, which again, you know, it worked to the 3DS's favor because it gave them all, you know, a sense of charm and creative energy and stuff. I'm thinking, for example, Persona Q was probably my favorite JRPG on the 3DS. And I say that as a big fan of Persona 3 and 4, obviously. And Persona Q brought all those characters together for Etrian Odyssey-style dungeon crawl, which was, you know, mixing a couple of my favorite things together, and it turned out well. They went for the decision to take the realistically proportioned characters from the original games and give them all big bobbleheads, and it really helped the sense of humor that the game then went with, and it gave a very different sense to how the story was approached in those original Persona games without actually breaking with, you know, the kind of characterization that I'd loved from the original games. So yeah, there were all kind of kind of developer tricks that were getting around the issues of the hardware with the console.
Yeah, and I think it's good, like, that they have that strength, because it just shows that you don't have to have, you know, every piece of hair rendered individually to have a beautiful game. You know, Bravely Default absolutely. Is a beautiful looking game, and it's a 3DS with, you know, the graphic quality is not up there with anything that we would consider cutting edge.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. Bravely Default is a great example of that. That's those two games were everything I think traditional Final Fantasy fans really wanted, and that was how Square Enix was able to give them that without tapping into the Final Fantasy franchise, and it ended up paying dividends because they got a lot of sales from those two games. Be interesting to see if we see that series come back again.
Octopath is by the new project for the Switch is by those developers, so we'll see what happens after Octopath, I guess.
Yeah, Octopath looks very different. It does look super different.
Yeah.
And it seems to be a much darker. I mean, Bravely Default had its dark moments, but Octopath seems to be taking things in a whole different. They're taking things to a whole nother level. Just from that demo, it's pretty brutal. In places.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, we say that, you know, the 3DS is on the way out. A lot of people will disagree for some crazy reason. You know, there are some releases. There are some good releases. Radiant Historia is coming out next month. The month after that is Shin Megami Tensei, whichever remake that is. Deep Strange Journey, I think. You know, but it's Pokemon is the next Pokemon is not coming out on the 3DS. The 3DS is dead. Like, that's pretty much the life cycle of Nintendo handhelds. You know, that once Black and White 2 came out on the DS and then the next ones weren't, the DS was officially dead at that point.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Fire Emblem's also moved to Switch development. There's going to be no more Fire Emblems on the 3DS.
And I'm not even sad about that at all, because as much as I love my 3DS, the Switch is a better console. I would rather have my experiences and my games from now be on the Switch.
Yeah, I've never had an issue with developers moving on to new hardware. That doesn't bother me. It didn't bother me when they stopped making games for PS3. It didn't bother me when they stopped making games for PS2. It doesn't bother me that they stopped making games for 3DS to move to Switch. That's just how things happen. I don't get why people get upset about these things, but they do.
Exactly. I don't know why, but, you know, because there will definitely be at least one angry person being like, oh, the 3DS isn't dead, blah, blah, blah. We've still got this and this and this. It's like, yeah, I mean, when we say dead, it's going to last into 2019, and it's still selling well enough that I'm sure Nintendo will start throwing, you know, some little projects at it like they did last year with that Mario Party, you know, top 100 mini games or whatever. It's going to be some releases like that they can put together and sell like that, just to give the 3DS owners that can't afford a Switch yet something to do. But it's basically over for the 3DS.
Yeah, and I guess there's some concern with a couple of franchises, I guess, that whether they can actually move to the Switch at all. The obvious one that I think of is Etrian Odyssey. Etrian Odyssey was one of those rare games that actually required that kind of dual screen experience, because the top screen was obviously all the action, and then the bottom screen was the map, which you had to physically draw, and the act of drawing the map was pretty important to it. When you look at dungeon crawlers on other consoles, they auto map for you, so you just pull up a menu screen basically, and you can see the maps as you go along, or it's up in the top corner being drawn as you explore. You can't do that. I mean, you wouldn't be able to do Etrian Odyssey's map drawing, manual map drawing mechanic that way. And yeah, I'm not quite sure how, if there is any plans to move Etrian Odyssey on, with how they would do that while still keeping the core of what the Etrian Odyssey experience is. So there are a couple of games that we might now lose out on because there's no more dual screen handheld or console experience amongst current consoles, but you never know. They might figure out something.
So Atlas did actually talk about the Etrian Odyssey series and where it will go. and stuff like that last year in September, and they sort of teased that the current one, like the Atrian Odyssey 5, will be the last game to use the 3DS bottom screen. So whether or not that means they're working to try and get something to work on the Switch, or if it's in development, or if it's just a thought or what, but it seems like they have some kind of intention to continue the series.
I'm sure the franchise itself will persist on in some form or other, because it's a valuable one for Atlus. It's become a fairly major JRPG franchise. But whether what concessions they need to make it work on the next generation of consoles is something we get to see. I suspect that it would just become a standard dungeon crawler with auto mapping, and it'll look beautiful because the Switch will render kind of the art style of the Atrian Odyssey series really beautifully, but it will lose some of its...
It'll lose some of the stuff that that current fans really do play it for.
Yeah, it will. And that's fine. That's the evolution of the series. You can't, if you're Atlus, you can't do much about it if there's no more dual screen consoles out there. You can't
exactly where they're going to make a weird like sliding attachment that adds a second screen.
Yeah, which no one would buy. It just wouldn't happen. So yeah, those things remain to be seen. But you know, for those people who really want the dual screen Atrian Odyssey experience, there are four of them on the 3DS as it is. I don't think three ever got a port, did it?
I don't think so.
1, 2, 4, 5. They're all on there.
Yeah. 5's really so great. I've only been going back and playing that recently.
Yeah, yeah. It came out last year. So there's still a lot of Atrian Odyssey out there if you want to play it and physically draw your maps. Okay, so we'll go on to talk about one particular JRPG in the next section. We're going to talk about Lost Sphere as a new release. And to lead into that, we've got a bit of music from Lost Sphere. Very beautiful soundtrack. This is The World of Memory, which I think is the one that plays on the main menu screen. I don't know. I've heard it a lot. I just can't remember
exactly where it is. If it is, it's a brilliant track.
It is. It's a gorgeous track. So whether it's the main menu one or not, I don't know. But it is a great track. So enjoy, and we'll be back and talking about it soon. Welcome back, everybody. Okay, so for our last section where we talk about one game in depth, I guess, this week we thought we'd talk about a new one because it is kind of the first major JRPG of the year, and it happened to be a really good one, Lost Sphere. I've got a review up on DiddyNet. I gave it 5 out of 5. which, as it turns out, is a bit higher than what some of the other critics have done. But, you know, screw them, they're wrong. I'm right.
I don't know. What is it, like, medic score, whatever, at the moment?
Sitting around 80.
Which is about all you can expect for a RPG. Jeez.
Yeah. Especially, I mean, Iron Setsuna didn't go down so great with a lot of critics. And I think this one was always destined to do the same because it is so closely aligned with what Iron Setsuna did. But, you know, this game was made for people who like story-driven JRPGs first and foremost. And there aren't that many critics out there that like that. You generally notice with JRPGs that do well with the critics, they're more gameplay orientated, like Nier Automata or, you know, Yakuza or Persona 5 or whatever.
Yeah.
Those are all very gameplay orientated. They have great stories, of course, but they are very gameplay orientated as well. Lost Sphere, I Am Setsuna, those kinds of games are, well, to the point where I don't really pay attention to the gameplay at all while I'm playing it. I'm playing it for the narrative.
And, yeah, that's right. I mean, it's pretty much the concession that Lost Sphere and I Am Setsuna makes is to cut things back to simpleness in the gameplay way. Whereas, you know, a big, huge budget game like Nier Automata and that sort of thing, they go fully in depth and have that crazy action battle system and the world. And, you know, they have I Am Setsuna and Lost Sphere make concessions just so they can get a really good, lengthy, decent story in without spending millions of dollars.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not unusual for niche JRPGs to do that. I mean, you look at Gust over the many, just about every Gust game is much the same. They have very limited gameplay because they generally focus on the characters and the story and all that kind of stuff. And that's what people like about them. So absolutely, they don't generally go down well with critics, but they find a niche audience and they kind of persist on because they're loved for that. But Lost Sphere in particular is a challenging one, I think, for a lot of critics as well, because it's very Japanese. And I don't mean very Japanese in the sense that it's got, you know, weird stuff going on, which is what a lot of people seem to think is Japanese. But it's, it taps into Japan's kind of Shinto faith system, which is pretty much exclusive to Japan. It's their religion, their native religion, and it's not one that necessarily we have an equivalent for out here in the West, and we don't necessarily understand it. It tends to confuse a lot of people, I find, when I talk to them about what Shinto is, and they don't seem to understand it even after you try and explain it to them. But it's basically the idea that, you know, everything has kind of a spirit to it and has a soul, and, you know, inanimate objects, people, animals, everything has that kind of that essence in it, and having a fundamental respect for that essence is a really important thing to the Japanese. And that's a very different thing to our very consumerist societies we have out in the West, where we tend to, you know, see objects as objects to be used, if not people these days, which is pretty embarrassing for us. But yeah, so it's a game that's hard for, I think, a lot of Westerners to connect with. And I think that's
Well, now that you've said that, now that you've given, you know, that the little cheat sheet notes on Shinto, it's that I can totally see that in the game, because that's something I didn't know about and I still don't really know, you know, that much about. Did you write about more in depth about that in your review?
Yeah, I did talk about it a bit in my review, in the first half of the review.
I'll have to read it after this, because yeah, that I definitely, I can just from you giving that little explanation, you can definitely see that in Lost Sphere, like straight away, even from the parts, the stuff that I've played, I can see that.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously we know that, or I know that the listeners don't know, you're not too far into the game at the moment. So we're obviously avoiding spoilers and I don't want to ruin it for you either, but yeah, this is something that, you know, permeates through the whole game. And I don't think it's preachy about it. It's not lecturing people. It's more, you know, this is just the core to the Japanese. It's something that they can't really get away from, so they've just put that into their game, probably unconsciously, but it's definitely there, and it's something that's quite foreign to us. So
yeah, I mean, it's
but yeah,
you go.
Sorry, you're gonna say something? Yeah, you go.
I was gonna say, you know, the Lost Sphere, we're talking about I Am Setsuna and Lost Sphere a lot as sort of like a grouping, but Losphere has made great, incredible improvements over Iron Setsuna. I think a lot of the things that even, you know, JRPG fans had a problem with in Iron Setsuna, it has been changed or vastly improved in Losphere. I think the battle system is better. You know, it's still not, you know, up there with the most complicated in the world, but it does give you more to do. The environments are more varied, and I think the game itself looks more beautiful. I think Losphere is actually a great looking game, the style and everything it does. So I think people, you know, who are maybe disappointed with Iron Setsuna being so bare bones in the gameplay department, and, you know, it did have a beautiful story, but it was sort of bare bones in everything else. I think Losphere really only compromises on, you know, that super in-depth gameplay. It doesn't have that, but it has a lot of the other stuff that Iron Setsuna was missing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a bit conflicted with how people or how we talk about Iron Setsuna, because yes, it's very simple, and obviously there's that the very wintry landscape, which is the entire game, means that there's a certain monotony that's built into it. And I think I certainly agree that for a lot of people that became dull. But yeah, I think Iron Setsuna's issue was that it had a very simple core premise, which is obviously the sense of sadness and melancholy about the quest, the journey, and what, you know, there's a sense of inevitability about what happens at the end of Iron Setsuna. And yeah, it's a very sad story, and that becomes difficult to want to keep progressing through. Whereas Lost Sphere is kind of the reverse, in the sense that it's a story about hope, and there's a hopefulness about it, that there's all these things that are happening and the world's disappearing literally in front of characters' eyes, but there's a solution to that. So there's always a sense that, you know, to right all the wrongs in the world in the process. So that sense of positivity and hope, even though it's still tonally quite sad and melancholic at times, Lost Sphere, that sense that there's something, you know, positive about what you're doing, gives it a more complex nuance than Iron Setsuna had, which, you know, translates into people feeling like it's a deeper experience.
And yeah, it definitely has, it's a different feel. Like the straight away when you start playing Lost Sphere, it's, you're not thinking, oh, this is a sequel to Iron Setsuna. You know, I think it straight away has a different feel and it's a different direction.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, it has, a lot of the themes actually cross across, and without trying to, you know, ruin too much of what you're going to experience going forwards in the game, it still deals with that sense that, you know, people are fundamentally flawed, and people, you know, all the characters you kind of come across, there's all these flaws on display, and you know, there's a sense that, you know, the game's quite critical about how humans think, in a lot of ways, think and behave. There's a lot of weakness amongst people. The impact that people have on the world is not always positive. So that was all in Iron Setsuna. That's all in Lost Sphere as well. And that gives it a certain tone, I guess, of, I don't want to say negativity, but it gives a certain critique of, you know, humanity's place in the world. But yeah, again, it also has that sense of positivity about it. It's, the characters are more bright and charming because they're younger, I think, as well. In Iron Setsuna, they're all adults basically, and they're all working together to take the sacrifice, you know, to where she needs to be sacrificed. So, you know, all of them have that kind of weight and burden on them, whereas in this one they're quite young kids to start with, and they have that kind of childishness, the youthful energy. They have a lot more banter between each other. So there's also that sense of playfulness and fun that comes up at points in Lost Sphere, which again gives it that extra depth and richness, which Iron Setsuna was lacking.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I'm a big fan of it. I'm a big fan.
Yeah,
of
so I do look forward. I've just been super busy. I haven't played it near as much as I want to. But yes, I fully am committed to playing that from start to finish. What I've played so far has been excellent. Just to start that off, because I played early preview sort of demo events. I actually played through this start three times now, like this starting hour about three times. And I wasn't, when I got my full copy, you know, I wasn't begrudgingly going through that first hour again. I think it is just an excellent experience.
Yeah, and it's worth mentioning that it's not the longest JRPG out there. It probably takes about 30 hours to get through, I want to say. So it's not going to chew up too much of your time. At the same time, it doesn't compromise on the story it's telling. So it's one of those examples of a JRPG that I really want to support because it knows how to be brief, still give you the full experience, which I think, once again, as I've mentioned a couple of times on the podcast before, certain developers such as Atlus with its Persona series could learn a thing or two from these guys because...
Yeah, they could have cut at least a 30-hour chunk off Persona 5 and still had a game of the year.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I can see myself playing Lost Sphere again at some point. I've played I Am Setsuna a couple of times because it was much the same. I can certainly see myself playing Lost Sphere again. I will not play Persona 5 again for a very long time, if ever, and that's the length thing. I don't feel like Lost Sphere tells a story of any less poignancy or depth or quality or richness than Persona 5 does. It just does it in, you know, a tenth of the words.
Yeah. Totally agree.
So on that note, we might finish up the podcast for this week. We've got a track from Xenogears to finish things off to get a little bit retro with our JRPG music. Thanks very much for listening in, everyone. Thanks for appearing on the show, Jay. Make sure you check out his YouTube channel. It's really good stuff.
Thank you very much, and thanks for having me.
No, thanks very much. Catch you next time.